Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today has written two books on the lives of the saints. He plays the saxophone and the keyboards. He's had three top 10 hits in the charts. And in his first frank autobiography, Fathomless Riches, told us about the difficulties of being a gay teenager, his fabulous pop success and excesses, and how he went from dogging to dog collar. Trading pop for the pulpit, he's now an Anglican vicar as well as a broadcaster and journalist. And the second volume of his autobiography, Bringing in the Sheaves, Wheat and Chaff from My Years as a Priest, is out now. Welcome, Reverend Richard Coles.
Hi.
I wanted to start off really where your first autobiography starts, and that's in fact on Christmas Day, and it was quite a crisis moment. I wondered if you'd take us back to what led up to what happened to you that Christmas.
Well, it was Christmas. I was in a period of my life when I just kind of crashed out of pop music and was sort of putting myself together again with a view to an uncertain future. Part of that was a recall, really, of what I'd grown up with as a chorister when I was a kid. So I sang in an Anglican choir when I was a little boy, and Christmas, of course, was a big part of that. And so I turned up for Christmas. It was at my parents', and I've got a limited tolerance for that sort of malarkey. And sort of after a while, I had just a bit too much of it, really. So I went out in my car, and in those days, I used to frequent a notorious spot where you could make a new friend, right? So I was there hunting for a new friend. On Christmas, I was still a bit desolate and wretched, but of course, I wasn't the only one. And there was a flashing of headlamps from another car, and a chap put his lights on, then got out and came over, I thought, to say hello, but in fact he stood in front of his headlamps completely naked, and he'd tied a tinsel bow around his genitals, and he then jumped up and down as a sort of, I don't know, extravagant way of redoing a carol, I guess.
How fabulous.
Happy Christmas, I thought.
And was it happy Christmas?
Well, actually, yes. I mean, I do remember that particularly. It seemed a rather, you know, kind of cheeringly, kind of public-spirited gesture, bearing in mind it was a cold night and people were there not really in you know, full-on Christmas mood.
No. I want to go back to the choir boy start because, of course, that informed your basic, I suppose, love of the church and of music.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I was very young. I was 7, 8 when I joined, and I was fortunate to have a good voice when I was a boy, a treble voice before it broke. And also, I'd kind of grown up very responsive to music. I'd always loved it from as soon as I was aware of it, I think, and responded very emotionally to it, bursting into tears at sad music and jumping around at happy. And then to be in a choir, an Anglican choir, and to step into what is a great tradition, and also to receive a training to a professional standard before you're even in long trousers, of course, sets you up for two things. One is a career in music, and I did that. And the other one is getting ordained in the Church of England, and I did that too. So it's, in a way, what I do. I mean, people often think it's an extraordinary move from pop music to pulpit, but really it was a return to where I began.
So from school, then, tell us about moving into the professional music world.
Well, it all began by getting run over, really. So I left school over at an English public school in my teenage years, partly because the shoe industry that had our family firm was based in and had provided the prosperity to send us to independent schools collapsed and died in the 1970s, like so many manufacturing enterprises in that period. So that rather closed off one future. And then I also realised that I was gay, and in 1978 in Kettering, that didn't offer a life rich in possibility, it seemed to me. So I was kind of looking for an out. And my mum rather brilliantly found this college in Stratford-on-Avon, where you could do your A-levels and study vocationally drama too, run by a very enterprising visionary called Gordon Vallin. So I went there. And while I was there, I got run over one day, cycling into college on my new bike just after my 18th birthday. And criminal injuries compensation was the consequence of that. I got 2,000 quid. Woohoo! And that was my ticket to London, because I sensed, even though I was by nature quite a sort of timid person, I sensed that the big city would be the place where I could start living the life I wanted to lead and walk into the future that I kind of hoped awaited.
And you met Jimmy Somerville there.
Yeah, another gay runaway. I mean, it was a 1980, I ran away from kind of comfortable middle class, middle England. He ran away from a very tough background in Glasgow. I remember when we met, I said, why did you run away? And he said, oh, people discovered I was gay. And I said, how? And he said that he was the only boy in his school who bunked off to watch the Bay City Rollers open a carpet shop.
Oh, that's fantastic. You decided to work together. And in fact, your first musical endeavour as a team was Bronski Beat.
Well, yeah, that was more Jimmy. I mean, Jimmy got together with two other guys, and it was really in response to Ken Livingstone. Ken Livingstone was then the mayor of London. And just to annoy Margaret Thatcher, who was then prime minister, he kept giving money to groups that she didn't like, including young gay Londoners. And so there was a gay arts festival funded by the Greater London Council. And Bronski Beat came together for that. And then so Jimmy started. And as soon as anyone heard Jimmy sing, you realised he was really a spectacular talent. And then he asked me to come in and play saxophone in Bronski Beat, which I did. And then he decided that he and I might go off and do our own thing, which we did, was the Communards. And in spite of our best efforts to be a worthy, right-on kind of niche act, Jimmy's talent was such that people kept buying the records, and so we became a sort of pop phenomenon against our better nature.
And trying really to write socialist pop.
Yeah, we wanted to bring down Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, really by doing covers of 70s disco classics. Where Are They Now? I mean, you hear a bit about it now, don't you, about entryism. There's this idea that you could kind of use popular culture as a tool for triggering the imminent revolution, which was going to come in and change everything, and we'd step forward into a brave new dawn. Mm. And, of course, it didn't work that way. But no apology for thinking that when I was 22. It seemed like a brilliant plan.
Well, and also possibly your socialist ambitions thwarted by the fact that you did become fantastically successful.
Yes, and that was really awkward because, you know, in spite of our sort of determination to set to music our critique of Thatcherism, we became a sort of exemplar of it in a way. Small business, who took advantage of opportunities, who enjoyed the benefits of deregulation and got the material benefits too of tax cuts, going around the world exporting British products. So I suppose we should have got a sort of pat on the head. There was a brilliant moment with that when we were in America and we were phoned up by Bruce Springsteen, name drop, to go and support him in a concert that they were doing in the anti-racist movement in France, live concert in the Chateau de Vincennes, broadcast live around the French-speaking world. Did we want to do it? Yes, we did. So we went over to Paris. The night before, there was like the French version of Newsnight, and they said, would you go on and debate Can Pop and Politics Mix? And we said, yeah, okay. So we went on, simultaneously translated English, French, and there was us, the interviewer, and on the other side, a French right-wing columnist to put a different view, and they asked me something like, you know, what's a pop band doing getting mixed up in this? And I said, oh, well, we may be a pop band, and we may live a life that seems very far from the lives of the people we're talking about today, but actually, wherever there are poor, marginalised, and oppressed and excluded people, wherever they are, that's where we are, because that's what we believe in. And the right-wing columnist looked at me and he said, I was behind you on the Concorde yesterday. So there were tensions.
I can imagine. And in the end, of course, it kind of burned out. How did it end?
Well, you know, partly because I never wanted to be in a pop band, and I realised it was never a realisation that I was going to have a short career. I just thought, I'll try and do this for as long as I can. The pressures on Jimmy and I as friends and also as working partners was it were intense. And the stuff that made us interesting, I think, which was the differences between us, we came from very different worlds, had very different assumptions, was also the stuff that when we began to pull apart kind of exacerbated it. And under the pressures of being in a big pop band, we began to sort of crack. And then, of course, HIV and AIDS came along, which was the best of times, the worst of times. And so we got all of a sudden woke up to this catastrophe of people dying of what looked like the medieval plague, undefended by everything that medical science in a great city and a developed nation could provide. And that was a very turbulent time.
And in fact, you caused a lot of controversy at that time by claiming that you had HIV.
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
Well, I thought I did have HIV. I mean, we were on tour and I came down with shingles, which was very often an indicator of someone whose immune system. And for lots of people I know who have been diagnosed with HIV positive, that began with shingles. So I was kind of thought that, oh God, that's me. And I went along to have a blood test with a rather dodgy doctor who bands used to use in those days for his discretion and liberal interpretation when it came to diagnosis. And there was a gap between having the test and the results. It was something about 10 days. And in the middle of this, I had gotten into a fight with Jimmy and I blirted out that I was HIV positive. And then got the results, and I wasn't HIV positive. So in a way, I was the only person ever to be slightly disappointed. So I had to go around and then tell everyone that I wasn't really HIV positive after all, which was kind of embarrassing. Mm. But of course, everybody went a bit mad in that period. And I don't think I was the only person to have kind of laid an unsubstantiated claim to that sort of status as someone who was kind of involved in it. But it was certainly not my finest hour.
Drugs too at that time, and then a suicide attempt.
No, the suicide attempt was earlier. That was at the end of my teens, actually. That was a kind of adjustment to, funny enough, often the way, isn't it? It was after I came out that I really had to deal with the kind of effects of having had to conceal that from people. And that was tricky. That was when I was 17. And then I didn't have a suicide attempt after that, although the drug taking was pretty much tantamount to a suicide attempt, I guess. But I got a grip. I just realised one day that I had to stop doing it because it was that or die. And I thought, well, I don't want to die, actually. So I kind of cleaned my life. I remember the sort of symbol of that. I remember going and buying some primulas and planting out my window boxes in Islington. And that was a sign that now I'd turned a corner.
And throughout all of this, was religion something that was still in your life? Would you have called yourself a Christian at that point, even at the height of your kind of 80s excesses?
Oh, absolutely not, no. I mean, of course, it was part of my life because I was formed in it, whether I liked it or not. But from very early on, I was determined, I mean, I was absolutely certain of one thing, which was that Christianity was a fairy tale and no one could live like that. So from the age of 8, I started the Wellingborough School Chapel Choir Atheists Club with my friend Matthew. And I can remember, I mean, it would have been a week before I finally submitted, that I would have thought, well, if I know one thing in an uncertain world is that I will never, ever, ever be religious. And then that changed very dramatically in a moment. Of course, in retrospect, it had been coming on for years. And the claims it made on me, even though I wasn't fully conscious of them, were nonetheless there and shaped me. And it was a sort of, it was a kind of moment of realization of a fundamental truth about myself. It sounds in a way, doesn't it, like coming out, another kind of coming out. And that was that.
And how did it manifest itself, that moment?
I was made to go to church by someone who said, look, you know, go to church, you need to just see, be part of it, see what happens. And I went in as a kind of reluctant spectator. It was solemn high mass at St. Albans the Martyr, Holborn, one of the great Anglo-Catholic shrines of England. And there were three sacred ministers robed at the altar, and one of them lifted up a white disc, and a bell rang, and a puff of smoke went up, and some sunlight, I remember coming in at an angle through the clerestory, hit that smoke, and I felt something within me just break. And I knew that, I tell you what, it was like being hungry and someone puts food in front of you. It wasn't a rational thing particularly. I don't remember anything that anyone said. I just remember that thing breaking, and then I knew that it was homeland, actually.
You actually then became a Catholic.
Like lots of people who adventure in the kind of highest of the high church circles, of course, you're haunted always that Anglo-Catholicism, Anglican, the Catholic tradition in the Church of England, is an imperfect thing, rather kind of knocked together in a church which is essentially a church of the Reformation. So you're rather haunted by the perfection and rigour and clarity of Roman Catholicism, original and best. And I think, like lots of people, I in the end found that siren song irresistible. And so I became a Roman Catholic and did 9 years, I think, as a Roman Catholic. And the net result of that was that I discovered I was Church of England. That the sort of fuzziness and indistinctness and lack of rigour of Anglicanism actually created room for a way of being, a way of living, a way of being a disciple too, I think, which sort of I couldn't do without. And also, I missed the hymns.
Hymns are great.
Well, hymns are great, not only because they're the soundtrack often of our childhood and growing up, but also in the Anglican tradition, we tend to sing our theology. And actually, there's an awful lot of theology in the hymn book, and I think that was where I was.
So taking holy orders, I mean, that must have been a huge decision to be ordained.
Well, yes, of course, it wasn't really something, I mean, what you discover is that it's there waiting for you to realise, if you see what I mean. And I kind of, this had been on the agenda for quite a long time, and I tried not to get ordained because I was very happy then with what I was doing in my life. I didn't want to...
What were you doing?
Well, I was by then working for the BBC, so I'd gone to university, I did a theology degree, and that was great, and I really enjoyed that. And then instead of getting ordained, I went to work for BBC Radio, which is about as close to getting ordained in the Church of England as you can get without doing it. And I mostly spent 9 years then presenting Nightways on Radio 3, its arts and culture magazine programme, which was just fantastic, but could never shake off the sense that the insistent call, as it were, to to do what I had to do. So eventually, it was Mo Molan made me do it. Old friend of mine from the Labour Party circuit of the 1980s, by then was a government minister and did enormous things in Northern Ireland, you know, a very contested, difficult political place. And Mo, who had little time for shilly-shallying, said, you need to do something about this. You need to make the call. Don't get to the end of your life and wish you had. So I did, and then I was very quickly went through the selection process, which is quite complicated and quite rigorous. And they said, yeah, we think you've got the vocation to ordain ministry too. And so I went off. I walked away from my comfortable life and everything in it and went off to be a student in a theological college.
And here you are, because your second autobiography, of course, documents really a year within the church. But through that, you're looking back not only at your own history, but at great moments in history. It's a wonderful book which sort of brings together lots and lots of different strands of things within the Christian life.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's a continuation of the story. But I finished the first book at the moment of ordination. And then, of course, at that moment, you become no longer the teller of your own tale, but the custodian of other people. So I couldn't continue to tell the story in the same way, because that would have cut across confidences which couldn't be cut across. So I used the structure of the church's year, which is still, I think, obviously most people in places like Britain notice when Christmas and Easter come round, even if they're highly secularised versions of it. But there's still a rhythm to it, I think. All Souls in the autumn, when we commemorate the dead, and the lesser-known ones like Corpus Christi or Transfiguration, but they still have a sort of power, I think, in informing and shaping the world we live in. So I use that as the structure, but really as kind of pegs to hang on experience of one kind or another, because most people's lives are sort of collages, aren't they, of one thing or another. And that's certainly true of parish clergy who wander around the world, on the one hand, trying to be faithful to an ancient tradition, on the other hand, encountering people in their infinite variety. Mm. And so that's how that happened.
I mean, you have a wonderful description of sort of Anglicans and particularly Anglican clergy saying how you can tell them a mile off. I mean, you talk about being recognised in a supermarket, not wearing your dog collar, and also, you know, thank you, Jesus, for the loaves and fishes, but is there a gluten-free alternative? That's so English.
It's so English. And of course, I think Oscar Wilde remarked that Jesus turned water into wine and the Church of England has been trying to turn it back into water ever since. And there is, you know, we're called to this extraordinarily exalted task, and yet find ourselves moving chairs, handing out hymn books, answering emails like everybody else. So there's this extraordinary, often think of Jacob's ladder, this kind of vertiginous climb, descent and ascent between the things of heaven and the things of earth, and you're kind of constantly up and down.
Do you have any kind of sense of a private life in that, not only because, of course, you're known for your pop career and your work on radio, but the fact that as a vicar, you are essentially public property?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, that's the kind of most noticeable continuity between having been in a pop band and becoming a vicar, is actually that you are sort of on display, and on display in all sorts of ways. And what you have to do is to create space in your life where you can live with the necessary privacy, although that does get, you know, kind of under attack sometimes. And also, it's not a burden that just you carry, but my partner David, he, whether he likes it or not, has to carry that too. And so you kind of work out ways of dealing with that, I think, or you try to.
But it must be extremely hard. I mean, you and David have a civil partnership.
Yeah.
But famously so, a celibate relationship because of what the church says.
Well, no, celibate relationship just happened that way. Lots of people I know, straight and gay, discover that the fires of desire burn low and yet the companionship continues. And so it just sort of happened that way, and that happened to coincide with the expectation of the House of Bishops that while together, we could not be together in that particularly intimate way. So it's just ended up conveniently that we conform to that standard. Mm-hmm. Although I think it's a ridiculous standard. I think it's daft. I think it's immoral, and I think it's inconsistent, and I don't think it holds any chance of really being taken seriously for very much longer. But nonetheless, that's where we are.
I mean, you write in your book that the church is cracked. You talk about, I mean, the whole discussion over women bishops, equal marriage, and so on. Is there any chance of that being healed?
Yeah, there's always, it's not only a chance, there's the inevitability of it being healed eventually, but don't hold your breath. I mean, these are very, very difficult issues. And, of course, what we're trying to do is reconcile interests, which on the face of it seem entirely irreconcilable until you remember that our common identity is rooted in Jesus Christ, who died on a cross in order to do precisely that. So we just have to be faithful to that and true to one another, acknowledging our common existence in that reality and what lies beyond that reality. And that's our hope. But it is a hope. It's not a reality.
Mm. So for many of us, the religious aspect of Christianity is not something that's particularly real in our lives. As you point out, there is a disconnect between form and content.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, the way the Church of England has been very good at that, we've been very good at giving people rich and complex and captivating forms, sometimes in a way when the content has got away from people. And that's partly because of our strange kind of schizophrenic nature, where we're both one thing and another, a church that's both reformed and yet also rooted in a Catholic identity before that, trying to make sense of itself in a world in where we have a particular status quo by virtue of establishment and by our bishops being in the House of Lords and by our ubiquitous presence in every community in the country, as people drift further and further away from our concerns. And there's a huge challenge in that, and also an opportunity, which is to rediscover each other. You know, we are the custodians of extraordinary riches. We've been around for a long time. We've seen human weal and woe and joy and disaster and all the rest of it. And we know something about that. And people, of course, still get into the same scrapes that they ever did. But what we failed to do is persuade people that we might be useful to them.
You write in your book about that first census, which is really where it all began for Christianity, and about really the unlikelihood of this teenage unmarried mother. And it's a wonderful passage.
Yes, I mean, if you thought Trump was unlikely or Brexit was unlikely, no one would have put money on God becoming incarnate, you know, in a stable in a dusty end of the Roman Empire there and then. But of course, if God does become incarnate, God becomes incarnate in a particular person, and then it has to be in a particular place, in a particular time. And one of the things I love about the nativity stories is just the beginnings of people getting it, the shepherds, you know, unlettered people in from the fields, all of a sudden realizing that what's in front of them is the fulfillment of hopes they maybe didn't know they had. The wise men with all their learning coming from the east and thinking, oh gosh, all of a sudden, what's this happening? And they go home completely altered by it. Mm. And this, that power to surprise and to transform and to challenge is still there, I think. And we intimated, I think, I just noticed it so much at midnight mass when people come back, people who are very far from what we do, and yet for that moment in church, in darkness, in candlelight, they gather at the crib and just connect to something that still has that power to captivate and challenge us.
Even if just once a year. I mean, you write a lot about people who describe themselves as having no religion and waking from the sleep of religion into the wakefulness of reality, a general decline in a willingness to be part of anything, you say.
Well, I think that's probably true. I mean, I think one of the irony, isn't it? And I suppose that we're, you know, the kind of received view is that we have kind of thrown off the slavery of religious belief and affiliation and woken up into a world of kind of infinite choice and self-realization. I think the opposite's the case, actually, because I think part of us is designed for a life made rich in the way that only religion can do it. And that's been a human constant in every culture throughout history. It still is for most people in the world today. We forget that in our kind of corner of it. And I think one of the kind of symptoms of the death of that within people is a sort of impoverishment. And we fill it in various different ways. Some people go to art for it. Lots of people, of course, go for the kind of satisfactions that material effort can bring through money or fulfillment through sport and the body or through sex, gratification of one kind or another. But I don't think any of those quite hit the spot. Now, you might think we're better off without it anyway, and that's an entirely respectable view. My experiences, particularly the longer I spend in parish ministry when I'm dealing with people of all kinds of, you know, who are living their lives, is that there is a sort of impoverishment, a kind of colourlessness about aspects of our lives, which I think is heartbreaking.
How will you spend Christmas Day?
Well, it's a game of two halves, Christmas Day, because Christmas Day, of course, begins on Christmas Eve, at midnight mass in particular. So we actually celebrate the Nativity at midnight, which is wonderful, and the whole community really gathers in church.
And that's your parish in Northamptonshire.
Yeah, and that's lovely, the gathering of the clans and so on. And then the next day we have the early, the 8 o'clock. So I have about 4 hours sleep, which makes me very grumpy indeed and not very Christmassy. So we have the earlies coming for the 8 o'clock. And then at our main service, we have There's still a tradition observed of the farmers' roundabouts coming in, dressed up in their Sunday best with all their families. So they come in, and then we shut up shop. And then I'm home and in my pyjamas within about 45 seconds of going through the front door. And so we sit in our pyjamas, the dogs have their stocking, and we usually put on a DVD and open a bottle of whiskey and actually just spend it actually quietly, just the two of us. My mum comes around sometimes. But I'm so, you know, clergy and so wiped out by the time people have sung the last chorus of Hark the Herald Angels Sing. It's kind of downtime.
Now, all over the world, people aren't necessarily celebrating Christmas, as we know. Lots of different religions in different places, and indeed our listeners are from everywhere. But if there was a sort of message to take away from somebody who has immersed himself deeply in a spiritual life, what would it be?
I think Christmas for me is a reminder, still powerful, still captivating for me, that in the middle of a cold, dark winter, in an unexpected and unlikely place, this light breaks. And at first it's just, you know, a pinprick of light in distance. But there's something about that light that's irresistible. And the closer you get to it, and the more you let that illuminate your world and yourself, the more you realise that there's a hope of transformation, of a new life beyond the boundaries, the furthest boundaries that we've imagined so far. And that's what makes angels sing and makes shepherds come in from the field to make wise men kind of rub their eyes in amazement. And that still has power to change us.
Reverend Richard Coles, thank you very much indeed. Bringing in the Sheaves, Wheat and Chaff from My Years as a Priest is published by Orion. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Claire Urban and Toby Hammond. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.